tell you the things that I could remember about your dad. And I'll see what I can come up with on it. One thing is that he loved to teach the gospel in any way. He could explain better than anyone I've ever heard. I do believe. I remember one of the experiences I can remember particularly about it. Well, when we were first married, we were both made state missionaries. And he was the ward leader, district leader, or something. I don't know just what it was. Antagonistic, if you remember how antagonistic they were about the church, especially Ruth. She was just really antagonistic, and it really, I could tell she was really getting hot under the collar for him to be talking with Jim, because I think Jim would have come around and would have believed and understood, because he was really proving things to him from the Bible, and they'd come from this, they knew a lot about the Bible. And but she just, I was trying to keep her, just talking Blue Street, trying to keep her occupied in another area of the house, and so as not to interfere with them, but to have a little swing at Jim. And finally, she couldn't take it any longer, and she interrupted him and had her say so. But I just was amazed at the way he explained the gospel so beautifully. And he loved his children and was really proud of them. And he spent a lot of time rocking the three youngest ones there when he was in the house a lot, not being too well. And he would still hold all three of you. He'd all pounce on top of him, one in the middle and one on each side. And tell you Bible stories or read to you. Well, we had what you kids call the true book. And he spent a lot of time reading that to you. I think that was your favorite. And he was so proud of his little kids. I remember we made the boys' shirts and all of your girls' blouses and alike. And you were all dressed alike. And then I think it was shorts that made you that were alike. And we went to Salt Lake, and all of you were, we went to the store. And I remember he overheard some women saying they had one fold of cloth and they bought it all, or something like that. And he really got a bang out of that. And he was so proud of his kids, his little children, I guess I should say. And I remember the day that Callie was born, speaking of his missionary work, he was going to baptize Callie Creeple, whom he had taught the gospel to, and her family. And they set the baptism up because they were afraid I'd be gone to the hospital if they waited until the day they had set. So they set it up for like a week early, and I decided to go to go into the baptism, and I decided, I guess I probably knew before we got in there, but I'd better go to the hospital instead. So he took me to the hospital, and of course I insisted to go to the baptism because that had to be. But he still made it down to the hospital in time for her entrance. And of course we had to name her Callie. One thing that was kind of fun that I remember about when you kids were little, we would, you were always coming in and getting in bed with us, all of you. And never how many was in there, like if it was all eight of you, why, we would start singing. When it was time that we had to get up, we would start singing, eight in a bed and the middle one said, roll over, roll over. They all rolled over, and one rolled out, seven in a bed, and the middle one said, and do like that until everybody was out of bed. He was really a great speaker and was quite in demand to just talk in different things. And one talk that I remember particularly that I was really impressed with and that he really got a lot of compliments on, that everyone thought it was real good, it was a stake youth group held in Monticello ward. And I remember it really impressed me, some of the things he said. One of them was, he was telling them how they needed to decide then what they would do when they were confronted with when they were confronted with decisions to make and moral issues that would arise, and whether they would drink or smoke or be immoral or anything, that they needed to decide right then in their lives early, and then when they were faced with the issue, then they would have already decided, and it wouldn't be such a so hard on them to decide, they'd already know. And the last talk that he gave was the day he was released, the French president, and it was just a couple of weeks or so before he passed on. And he hadn't been able to go for some time, and his counselors were carrying on, and the state presidency had waited for up for them to release him, because they were afraid it would make him give up. But they finally decided that they had to release him. And they came down to pick him up that morning, down to the house. And he needed to go to the hospital and was supposed to go. And the only thing that ever gave him any strength was if after he'd go get some blood, get blood transfusions. And but he was bound and determined that he was going to go to church that day. And to be released, and he wouldn't go to the hospital until after it was over with. I believe he went in that afternoon after church, if I remember right. But the night before that, he was so weak that I had to feed him. I had to take the spoon and feed him because he was too weak to feed himself. And I had to help him from the chair to the bed, and he just was so weak. And yet that morning, made the statement, he said if President McKay could get on a plane on a stretcher like he did when he went to the Oakland Temple to dedicate it, he had enough faith that he would be all right and be able to get off, and he was, and able to go and dedicate the temple, he said, then I can have enough to go to church tomorrow. And he said he would be able to. And he just bound and determined he was going. And he not only went to church with the help of the ones that came to pick him up, but he was able to speak for like 20 minutes. His throat got real dry like it did, and Kim got up, went out and got him a glass of water, took it up to him. But he was able to speak for like 20 minutes, to stand there and speak. And I know Charlene commented afterwards that she thought it was the best talk she'd ever heard. And he was really a good speaker, and everybody loved him. At least I don't know of anybody that didn't. The only person I think that I ever knew that he had feelings towards, or that even had a problem with, I guess it was, you know, someone's always cheating different people like that. And I know the guy that bought a car from him once cheated him, and he didn't keep track of the payments. Well, he did keep track of them, but the guy evidently didn't, and he said it was paid for when he still had like $250 payments. But I mean, I don't think he really held feelings towards it or anything like that, but I just remembered that because maybe I did. But there was someone that dealt with him on something else. Seems like it was an old truck he bought, the old truck. And he really did him dirt. I can't remember what it was even about, but it was something that your dad bought from him anyway, and he really cheated him and did lied about it, and just, it was awful. And your dad was having a real hard time with his feelings, and he wasn't the type to hold feelings. He didn't believe in it, but he was having a real hard time not holding feelings to this guy. And then he went into the hospital, and they would have to get his blood out of Salt Lake, and they needed it right then to save his life. And they couldn't get any out of Salt Lake. And there was nobody else. They checked the records. There was nobody else in the whole area, San Juan County, I guess, that they could find that had that blood type except this man. And he came in and gave him blood and saved his life. I don't think he ever had another bad feeling towards him. I don't think he probably never saw him again or anything, but it was just almost like it was meant to be, you know, so that he wouldn't have. And one time he went in the hospital, I think this was in October, or September or October, and it was one of the last times he went in. And he was that was the time he was so bad for so long, for 7 days and seven nights I was in the hospital with him. And I remember he had heat cups once, and he was just kind of in and out, kind of fading in and out during that time. And he got to where they weren't able to even give him a blood transfusion because his veins had all collapsed. And they called me in and told me that there wasn't any hope for him, that he just wouldn't make it. And I says, he will. Yes, he will. I know he will. And I wouldn't believe him. And you kids wanted me to fast that Sunday. It was Fast Sunday, and you wanted to fast the full 24 hours. Usually you didn't fast only one meal. You know, you'd eat after you got home from church or something until you were 12 years old, and then you'd fast a full 24 hours. And Becky was 8, if she was that old. She's just 8 years old. And so she usually, the ones 8 only fasted until after church. And but she was bound determined she was going to fast the full 24 hours. And I remember that you started your fast, I think, on Saturday. I think we did, so that it would be that afternoon after, you know, so I could go back into the hospital. And Thora came and stayed with him. But before the time was up, before the 24 hours was up, then Becky got sick to her stomach, and she was had the dry heaves and just couldn't quit, just so nauseated. And I tried to get her to at least take a little bit of juice or to drink some water even, and she wouldn't take anything. She said no. She was going to fast a full 24 hours for her daddy, and which she did. And then after the fast was over and we had our prayers and everything, I went back into the hospital, and they met me at the door and told me they'd been able to get blood in his veins, because they saw me coming. They had just been able to get the needle in his veins, and that he was having a blood transfusion, and it was reviving him. And Uncle Albert came, gave him a blessing, and promised him, I don't know just what he promised him, but like he, it sounded like he was going to get well. At least he was going to be able to go home and go about his work and things, which he did. He went home, and he was, it just like it was arrested for a certain period of time, and he had pretty good strength and went to the fields and did his work and everything. And one thing, while he was so bad at that time and was in and out, he said that his father, he saw his father, and that his father was standing there looking ahead, just a side view, like he was waiting. And he felt like that his father was waiting for him. And he then his father left, and your dad started getting well from that time, and just seemed to, maybe until he was able to leave the hospital. And it seemed that his time was probably up then, but because of the faith of you kids, the Lord spared him a little longer, and he was able to go home for a while longer. And let's see, I guess it was that December that he went back in the hospital. He said he wasn't going to go. He was going to be home for Christmas no matter what. But Christmas morning he had to go back to the hospital. It was a matter of life or death. And he went back in, and so we all went in. We took him the little train that Uncle Trav had given him. We took the train in and run it around in the hospital for him to see. And he was in a wheelchair. And I remember for years Leonard remembered Daddy in that, I can't remember what he called it, funny chair or something. Like when he died, he remembered him for a long time in that bed. Like, I can't remember what he said about that, but those were the two things that he remembered about him the longest, those two things. And that train was a-tooting all over the hospital, I mean all over the lobby out there, making a big noise. But anyway, then he went back, and he was able to go home. I mean, Grandma Barton, I remember, wanted him to come in and stay. That was the hardest thing for me to do, is let him go there when I knew when time was so precious with him. And he didn't want to go either, but she wanted him to, just to kind of insist on it. She was quite a strong-willed lady, and she wanted just him in there with her for a few days. So I remember they took him in, and he stayed there with Grandma for a few days. I can't remember how long, but we were so glad to get him home again. And then he went back in January, and that, of course, was the last time that he went in. And it was between when he was in there in December and there in January that he would spend part of his time with Grandma Barton. So he wasn't really home very much before he went back that last time in January. And Grandma Barton was then ready for him to go. And I knew she knew that it was his time too, and she wanted to spend those few days with him also, because they had a real close relationship, and she loved him very much too. And she had a dream where her sister appeared to her, her sister that had gone on. In fact, it was Uncle Albert's first wife, Aunt Lale, that appeared to her in black. And I can't remember the dream now, but she knew that that he was going to go. And so when he went back in that last time, then she said, I want to have someone give him a blessing now, this time. And she had L. Frank Red come and give him a blessing. And what he really did was released him from mortality. I remember one thing he said was, "I bless you that you will now have the blessing which that the Lord intends for you to have." And I think he went on that mission because at one time, just before he got sick with Hodgkin's, which was about 2 years before then, that he made the comment to me. You know, he was such a great missionary, and he loved missionary work so much. He says, "What would you think if I called?" Of course, he was just talking. At least I guess he was, but I knew that down deep he was really feeling how wonderful, how much he would love to, had such a strong desire to do missionary work, and so good at it. And he says, "What would you think if I called myself on a 6-month mission during the winter when, you know, things were..." As well, he was branch president. He says, "And just let my counselors carry on while I was gone." Of course, I'm sure he wasn't going to do it, but he just asked me what I thought of it, because he just loved missionary work so much. And I says, "Oh, sure, you know." I mean, I thought, "Oh, sure, you're going to leave me with 8 kids and him go on a mission." I wasn't, you know. And then nothing was ever said about it again that I remember of it all. And it was just kind of a thought that had come to him. But I knew that he had a great, great desire to go on a mission. And I think when Elder Kimball blessed him that he would have the desire of his heart, and I thought it meant that he would get well. I'm not really sure. And then when right near the end, I reminded him of President Kimball's... and I think then that his desire was to get well. And all, but right near the end, when he was so bad, then and he was in so much misery all the time, and I said to him one day, he told me, you know, that he thought he was going to go, and was trying to kind of preparing me in a small way, and he was more trying to prepare for Odell, because he didn't dare really say much to me, but he got all these papers out and showed Waddell just how to take care of business things, his income tax and everything. They had everything in a box. But he was kind of trying to prepare me, I guess. And I said, reminding what Elder Kimball said about that he would have the desire of his heart. And he says, "Well, I'm not real sure what the desire of my heart is." He says, "I can't be a good father. The kids, the noise and everything, just, oh, it was really, really hard on him. And he had a hard time to keep from yelling at the kids, although I didn't think he was bad at it or anything, because not as bad as I would have been, because kids were real noisy. You know how 8 little kids are around in the house." He says, "Everything, all the noise bothered him so much." And he says, "I can't be a good husband, I can't be a good father." And he says, "I'm not sure what the desires of my heart are at this point," or something like that. And so anyway, he was able to go on his mission. And I know he's doing a lot of good on the other side. I know he's a great missionary. And someday we'll realize how much he has done and be so proud of him. And like Uncle Albert told me once, he says, he's doing things on the other side for his family here that will save them a lot of time later on. I mean, it'll help them a lot later on when they go beyond. He's doing a lot to, I can't remember now just how he worded it, but that was the drift of it, that he was doing things for us over there too, and that would give us an advantage when we do go to the other side. But anyway, that last time that he went in, he was too weak to walk. And Rex came down and carried him to the car, carried him in the hospital. He didn't weigh very much, so he wasn't very heavy. It wasn't anything very hard for him to do. And
that was the time that Grandma said she wanted Elk Frank Red to give him a blessing. And I believe I mentioned it before that he came and blessed him, that he would now have a blessing that the Lord intended for him to have. And I think that was a blessing the Lord wanted him to have, was to go to the other side. And I'm sure he's got a great work for him to do on the other side. So anyway, right after he had this blessing, and I was sitting there at the hospital with him, sitting facing him, because I needed to hold the needle in his wrist so that there was no way of it coming, so it wouldn't come out, because if it come out, they wouldn't be able to get it back in again. And they were giving him this blood transfusion. And he was looking up at the ceiling, kind of in the corner of the room, and he was so weak that he was having a hard time. I couldn't hear what he was saying. He was trying to talk to me, and he would look at me, look up there, and just like, "Can't you see?" And then he kind of motioned up there with his hand, and I just had a blank on my face. And I know he said, "His father, father." And I think that it was his dad that was there, because he was the one that was going to come for him. And I think he was there. And then right after that, he kind of smacked his lips. He wanted me to kiss him. And so I kissed him, and he went right into a coma. That was just wanting to kiss me goodbye. Well, they can see so much, and he knew so much. And if I could have just seen what he was seeing. And he went right into a coma. And then Afton had come. I had called her, I think, a little bit before that, when he was so bad. And I think she came about then, walked in the room about that time, about the time he went into this coma, and it was with me there. It was just a matter of maybe 10 minutes or so. I don't remember just how long. It wasn't very long until he was gone. And I remember walking out of the hospital, looking at the clock. I can't remember now what it said. It seemed like it was 6 something. The evening. And I remember Dr. Smith asking me to come into the office. I didn't shed any tears or anything. The most peaceful, wonderful feeling came over me immediately as he left. As soon as he left, and I knew that everything was okay. This peace that surpasseth all understanding. The Holy Ghost was right there. And if I hadn't believed right up to the end that he would be made well, I don't think I could have stood it. But at that time, you know, being stretched over such a long period of time, but I believed clear up to the end that he would be made completely well. And I'm glad that it happened that way, because that peace, that like you unless you feel it, can't even comprehend it. That peaceful, peaceful feeling came over me. And he called me in his office, and he said, "You've got to get a hold of yourself," or something like that, you know, because I wasn't shedding any tears or anything, and they couldn't understand it. And then I kind of half broke down a little bit, and I said, "He's the one. I don't know what I'll do without him." I said, "He's the one that really taught the gospel to the children." I was so busy all the time, and he was always teaching. All used every teaching moment to teach you to. And I said, and anyway, this Dr. Smith's been working with us there at the temple. Him and his second wife, his first one died. They were just called on a mission to France. And she was on your dad's shift, one that he's assistant supervisor, your dad's assistant supervisor of. And so we got quite well acquainted with him. But anyway, let's see, there was something else. Oh, after he died, another thing I wanted to mention just for you, Jan. Uncle Trav, you know how good he was to us. I don't know what we would have done without him. He would come and check over our car. He would take care of everything and for us. And the thing that I appreciated more than anything else. And then he made me quit milking the cow and sell it. And he'd milk it twice a day, his twice a day. Because ordinarily, after a while, he'd start just milking his once a day till it dried up again. Because they didn't need the milk. And so he milked it twice a day and gave us one milking, and they would have the other one. But, because I guess he knew how stressful it was. I was very independent. I wouldn't let him milk our cow. I insisted on it. But, you know, where it was, clear down over the hill, and that winter, the snow was really deep. And I remember I would walk down there and leave all you little kids in the house getting ready for school by yourself and taking care of things. And I'd walk down there and I'd sit there at the cow and I'd fall. And that's the only time I'd ever really shed any tears, I think, but when I was milking that dumb cow, because I didn't like want to do it and I wasn't good at it. And I don't know. Anyway, I think he knew that it was stressful for me, although I didn't ever really let him know. But anyway, he insisted I sell it. But the thing I appreciated more about him than anything else, you missed your daddy so much. All of the kids really missed him, but I think you and Jed, because he would take Jed on the tractor, and he'd keep him out all day long some days, but he would usually take him when he wasn't going to be gone so long. But it still worried me, because he'd go to sleep on that tractor, and he wanted to spend every minute with his dad. And so his dad would take him a lot. But I don't know, it seems like you, all of you, I'm sure Audra did too, though. Audra and Leonard really missed him too. You and Audra and Leonard really missed your dad. I remember, but Uncle, you wanted to be held, and you always liked the man. You never would go to any of the women, but you'd always like the man. So as soon as Uncle Trav would come in the house, you'd go get on his lap, and he'd rock you and rock you and rock you and let you twist his hair with your finger. And anyway, I really appreciated that, because that at least helped you. And let's see, I had another thought. I can't remember it now. Anyway, Uncle Travis was sure good to you, to us. But another thing we used to always do was we'd take all you kids to the bean fields with us so I could help him hoe weeds. And we'd take things for you to make tents, and we'd take a picnic lunch, and you kids would play around down there all day in the middle of the bean field, make your little tents and things. And I helped hoe weeds. And I remember once when your dad wasn't able to hoe the weeds. The weeds were thick, and there was lots of tractor work needed to be done. And I remember the whole community came out with tractors and with hoes and everything, and everybody. I'll bet there was 100 people there. Everybody working, men, women, and children. And everybody helped with everything and that needed doing. And then after we got through, they had all brought potluck, and we had potluck down there at the cabin. And those kind of things are priceless when you think of the community all doing something like that. Leonard and Jed both remind me a lot of your dad. Leonard in some ways and Jed in some ways. I remember when he stood up to speak, he kind of opened his mouth a second before anything came out. Jed's the same way when he goes to speak. And Jed's voice sounds exactly like his. And yet there's Leonard I think Leonard has his temperament. Well, he had a temper too, though. Like, I think Jed's got more of a temper. He could take a lot, but once he got mad, he got mad. But it didn't happen very often. Like Kim mentioned to me one time, I was pulling the equipment on the tractor in, and then he had to come through on the pickup, or no, he had to come through on the tractor, and I had to go through on the car, and I didn't go up far enough, and he got off and he couldn't get through, so he hollered, "Go up a little further." So I pulled up a little further, and it wasn't far enough. And then he says, "Pull up there about a mile." And so I pulled up there about a mile, and I remember he got kind of hot under the collar there for a few minutes. But he didn't use his temper very often, but he did have one. And but he also was a lot in nature like Leonard. And he just, oh, I don't know. There's an awful lot about Leonard that reminds me of him, and I think both of them remind me a lot of him when I'm around either one of them. Both of them. I remember when, after he died, and went to the grave, I mean, went to the to Grandma Barton's in Monticello, and how, I think Kim mentioned this, so I thought I'd mention it. How Leonard went up and put his hands on the casket. I couldn't have cared less if he put his little hands on his casket trying to see his daddy. And Grandma Barton made him get them off so he wouldn't get it dirty. And, I mean, that shouldn't let it bother me, I guess, but I did let it bother me because I didn't care if he got it dirty, his precious little hands on it. And, let's see. When after he passed away, I called Herma and asked her to go down and to the house and tell you guys that he was gone. And when I come home, you all acted like you didn't know it. I mean, you just talked about your daddy like he was still alive. And I turned to Herma and I said, "Didn't you tell them?" And she says, "I did, but they wouldn't believe me. They just says, well, as soon as Uncle Albert comes and gives him a blessing, then he'll come back alive." That's what somebody, one of them, said to her. But he didn't that time. But just think of all he's doing for us on the other side and things that's going to make it so much better for us when we go over there. And about just a day or two, I think it was the next day after he died, then on Sunday, must have been on a Saturday then, and on Sunday, Charlene came to our house before church and brought some fish. And she walked in the house and she said, "These are for President Barton." I says, "Oh, Charlene, you haven't heard." And she felt so bad and broke into tears. She didn't know that he had gone. And you know, to come like that and all. And the night that he died, Aunt Mary came over to spend the night with me. And I still had that peaceful feeling. It stayed with me, it seems like, it just never really left. And I was so tired because I had been with him so much that, anyway, she came and spent the night with me, and she had a hard time sleeping, laid awake, and I went right to sleep and slept all night, I think, because I was so tired and just exhausted. I slept good. But I think there's very few children in the whole world that have any have a father any better than what he was, what he is, because he had so much love for his children, and he was so anxious to really teach you all the gospel and to help you to really understand it. And so you can really be thankful for him. While I'm at it, I thought I'd tell him something else. You remember how after he was gone, how we went to decided to build that room in the basement. We built two rooms, in fact. We built a storage room, another storage room, where we had the wheat grinder, a table down there, and a wheat grinder set up on it. And then we built that beautiful big room for you girls, bedroom, with a really nice bath, had all that built. And Max did a lot of the work. We had got plumbers come out from Blanding to do the bathroom, but he did a lot of the work, most of it. And he told me how, I mean, he just couldn't believe how you two were playing around him all day, just playing, you and Leonard. And he just said he had never once heard you quarrel. And he was just so amazed at how well you two got along. He had never seen kids that got along so well like that, never quarreling at all. And you did. I don't think you would never quarrel. You and Leonard wouldn't. You were always so close and played so well together. I just thought you might like to be reminded of that. I'm sure. I hope you have some kids that'll not quarrel with each other someday like you two didn't. Because all the rest of ours did, but you two didn't with each other, not at all. Life, I have had some really sacred experiences, which I might mention here too. I know as I get older, I think of that song, "More Longings for Home." More, there's just one sentence in it, and I know I feel a longing, more of a longing, to be with my Heavenly Father in my heavenly home. It just seems more real, and I feel like I'm closer to Him than when I was younger. And I'm looking forward to the day when I will be with Him. And I I'm looking forward to the day when I will be with you, Father. And I think that that keeps me, I mean, to know that He's over there, and that I can't think of anything worse than to come to the end and may not be worthy to be with Him, or to be with Him or with my Heavenly Father. And so, and my testimony is that He is there waiting, and that both of them are there waiting. The greatest desire of my heart is that I will one day be with Him, and also that each one of my children and each one of my grandchildren, and this is the prayers I have every day, that we will all be together and be back, be with each other, and that family unit. So I want your children to teach your children really good, because this is a terrible, wicked world, and it's going to get wickeder, and the only way we're going to be able to endure is to have their own testimonies. Each one of them have their own testimony, because we won't be able to endure our world life, and so we have to develop this faith and all these things, and it teaches you through the trials and things that come to us, that after they're over with and gone, then we can see the faith that we have developed through them. And we're going to have a lot of it to be able to endure these dark days that will be ahead. And with that faith, then they won't seem so dark because they'll have the gospel light. I remember at one time that it was during the war, and I was nearly 25 when I wasn't married, and I had been writing to you, Dad, for like a year, but there wasn't anything really there. I had a blind date, and on blind date with McQueen Smith, that's of Albert's daughter and his daughter, and her and I were big fans, and she wanted me to go with her cousin from Monticello that had just come home from the mission. And she invited me to a party at her house. And then after that, he wrote and asked me for another date. Her and Uncle Albert's wife, Aunt Gladys, they schemed this up. They wanted to match us up. And wrote and asked me for another date. By then, I'd gone to Phoenix and was down there living with some friends and working. And then later, I went to Salt Lake with Vivian Morrison, local to her. But I wanted to get married. It was during the war, and there weren't. Quite like that I was dating once in a while, and I really liked Lynn. Somewhere he was a distant relative. He was going to BYU, and I really, really liked him. But nothing was working out anywhere. And I remember I'd been telling the Lord who I wanted all this time, and I wasn't leaving it up to him. And I finally realized that what I'd been reading the scriptures, now what I needed to do was leave it entirely up to the Lord and ask who he wanted for me. And so that's the way I was started to praying. And I fasted, not for 24 hours, but for 48 hours did I fast. I remember walking down the streets in Salt Lake and the drinking fountain there, and how badly I wanted to drink of that water and how thirsty I was. But anyway, at the end of the fast, 48-hour fast, I went to the temple. And I don't remember, it doesn't seem like it was, I can't remember when it was, I heard a voice speak to me, but a voice spoke to me and said, quit your job and go home. Just as plain as I'm speaking now, quit your job and go home. And I've heard that voice speak twice in my life, to me twice in my life. One time, I was, like I say, I was fasting and praying for an answer. And I was praying, show me who, show me what to do. What would thou have me do? And the other time, well, that's about it too. I mean, I had to do all this fasting and praying and all to get myself in tune so that the Spirit could direct me. And I didn't want to go to Blanding. That was the last place in the world I wanted to go. I remember I went home and I started crying. I told my roommates, Fidel and Vivian. I said, I don't want to go home. I'll just go down there and marry Evan H. And I don't want to do that. And I want to marry somebody else. There's two guys I like. And so anyway, the Lord had made it real plain to me. So I went home. And anyway, in about a month, I was engaged. And that's who the Lord wanted me to marry. And I couldn't have had it but my wonderful husband. He was really, really a wonderful person. And then, we, as you know, we did a lot of fasting and praying to know that we were to go to Hiram. And it did, I know we were guided every inch of the way. Because right after your father died, Herma said to me, there's no way I would stay around here if anything happened to Rex. And I said, Herma, I love it here. There's no way I would leave Eastland. There's no way. But the Spirit started working on me, and different things, I think of little things down the way that made me finally decide that, well, for one thing, we went up there and visited with Bay, and then we visited with Nelson's over in Smithville, and they all tried to get us to move up there. And you come up here, and you can, there's a temple right here, you can work in the temple. That really intrigued me. We would go up there and work in the temple. It would be something to do. And the kids would be close to college and everything. And so we came home and we started fasting and praying about it. We just didn't want to leave. There's no way you want to leave your friends. But as we fasted and prayed about it enough, you started feeling like that's what we were supposed to do too. The older kids decided, felt like that's what we were supposed to do. And so we, as you know, we finally moved up there. And then it was no doubt inspiration that we found the home we did and that things worked out like they did. And I know that it was just about, we moved up there in May, if I remember right, last of May, or the first of June, something like that. Right after school was out. And this one day, I know I've told you this before, but I don't have it written down. I was over to Faye Trout's, helping her can pears. And at this time, I felt closer to the Lord than I probably ever had in my life. I was studying my scriptures a lot and reading books. I remember I was reading Masterful Discourses of Orson Pratt, different ones that were just really great. And spending a lot of time with things like that. And I was working in the temple regularly. I can't remember if it was one or two days a week doing sealings. And I just felt closer to the Lord than I had felt. And even though I wasn't asking for any special blessing at this time, or even thinking of getting one, the phone rang, and Faye went to the phone. And then she turned to me and she says, Bishop Wendry's wife has just been killed in an automobile accident. And a voice spoke to me. I think it was that same voice, loud and distinct. And you will marry her husband, or marry Bishop Wendry. I can't remember just exactly what it even said now. But I was told that I would marry him. And I remember I'd go to church, and I didn't dare look at him. And I'd never speak to him. I'd go on my way, you know, even. And then he came over to the house, you know, checked on us a time or two, and just as with your kids, just as, to, you know, the kind of person he is. He checks on everybody and visits with everybody and is thoughtful and considerate of everybody. And then one day he called me and told me that about this institute thing in Salt Lake where he needed a partner, that the faculty was going down there. And that was probably in the spring, and his wife had died in September. And he said, ask if I'd like to go with him. And I made all the excuses in the world. I remember I even said I don't even own any heels or anything. Because I thought I'd have to dress up, you know. And he says, I couldn't care less. And he said, if you know, if I really didn't want to go, that he could take it, one of his daughters, take Debbie. But he would thought of me sitting over there alone. And he thought I'd like to go. And maybe I'd like to go with him. And anyway, but I knew, you know, I'd already had this been spoken to, and it just scared me too bad. So I just made all these excuses. And but anyway, I ended up going. And then he asked me if I'd like to go out with him again. And I said, well, I need to go to Ogden. I'd like to go to Ogden because my friend down there is having a wedding reception for her daughter, Little Ann Johnson. family reception for her daughter, and I said that I'd really like to go to. And so he took me down to that. And I don't remember one other time of even going out with him, and then we went to over to some cafe or something and went in and had ice cream or something when they were very big. And I felt like him a few times, and I remember he always had a scripture sitting in the seat between us. I don't know why, but he always had a scripture sitting in the seat between us. And I accused him of having them there for protection. And then, anyway, we went to the temple and fasting, and there was a special experience there, which probably had not mentioned because it had something to do with going to the veil. But I already knew, and so anyway, those were the few times in my life that I heard a voice speaking to me. And then there was another time when I felt the spirit so strong that it was as good as speaking. And that was just before your father and I were married. We went to Mesa and we spent the night with a friend down there. And we bought the ring, and jammed the ring down there. I haven't had an engagement ring, so when we found this one, I just said, there's no point. We didn't have money. We didn't have very much money or anything. Let's just get this and have it for both. But anyway, I just had the most awful feeling, like I didn't know it was Satan. I know beyond any doubt it was, because he knew how important that marriage was and how I should marry him. But I had this bad feeling that morning as we were driving over. We got in the car finally. Well, all the day before, it seems like I had it. Or with the rings made. But, like, I would back out if it wasn't that two different cars of people were coming down from my family, from Landon and his family. Maybe more than two, I don't know. But coming clear down there to Mesa to be with us at that wedding. And I didn't dare back out. I didn't know what to do. And so anyway, I prayed, of course. But anyway, I still had that bad feeling the next that morning. And when we got out in the desert, he sensed it. And he said, let's have prayer. Let's stop and have prayer. And he offered the most beautiful prayer. I can't remember now what he said or anything about it. But when he got through praying, and I looked up, the sun was just coming up over the desert in the most peaceful, wonderful feeling just went clear through my whole body. Just like, I think of Lorenzo Snow when he spoke of the Holy Ghost, like the rustling of garments or something. But the most peaceful, wonderful feeling. I didn't hear any ghost speaking or anything, but I had this most peaceful, wonderful feeling. So I really had those three real strong experiences that have left no doubt whatsoever in my mind with the Spirit. The workings of the Spirit, and how close we are to the Spirit. I mean, how close we can get to the Spirit, and how mindful our Heavenly Father is of each one of us, and how much He does love us, each one of us. There's not one of us that He doesn't really, really love, and knows us really well. And anyway, that peaceful feeling remained with me all day. There was some other couples being married at the same time, and they were nervous and everything, and we were just so calm and peaceful. And it was just a beautiful, wonderful occasion. But I remember one thing that President Payne said to us. He gave a lot of fatherly advice. I remember one thing he said was not to always have prayer. He thought not to let one night go by without having prayer together, no matter what. He said if you pray together, you'll stay together. And I doubt that we ever let one night go by without prayer. Because that, it seems like if we had prayer and we would pray, then things just worked out. And we didn't very often have feelings. We just had such a wonderful marriage. But I do know that the Spirit is there and that the Holy Ghost can be with us to the degree that we can feel that peace, and I'm looking forward to feeling that peace throughout eternity. Because we are told that if we love the Lord, that we will have that peace that surpasses all understanding. And that's what I'm living for and hoping for, is to have that peace within me at all times. And I might say also that my patriarchal blessing says that peace shall ever be with you. All this world can tell it to you. Anyway, it tells me that I will have peace and peace and joy. Oh, I know what it says, but just because I'm trying to think of it, I can't think of it right off. But I've had more peace, I think, in the last year than I remember about ever having. Because, I don't know, I guess it's because Dave's a patriarch for one thing, and there can be no contention in the home. And there's just a peaceful, peaceful feeling. Even when we have trials and a few troubles or something, there's still a peace in our home. And I bear my testimony tonight to you that I do know beyond any doubt that the gospel is the only way, and that our Heavenly Father loves us, wants more than anything else for each one of us to come back, and He'll do all in His power to help us. There's things we have to do on our own, but He will do all that He can. And I hope this will be of some help to you all.